Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about Kenpo and the martial arts and whatever else we decide to talk about. I am Reggie Darden, and today I have great guest with me today. We got a Donnie Jeffcoat with us, and we're just going to jump in and talk some Kenpo. So to give a little bit of my background, and we kind of touched on this before we started recording, but just kind of go through it here. So I started, I've always been a big fan of the martial arts and watching, you know, the Black Belt Theater, Kung Fu Theater back in the day, you know, all the Jackie Chan movies and Shaw Brothers movies and all that good stuff. And wanted to, you know, always wanted to do the martial arts, but couldn't do it because of my father would not let me. Now I don't have any official facts to back this up, but he said that he used to be a bodyguard for Muhammad Ali, and he said at the time, you know, martial arts and karate and judo and stuff were just getting popular in the States, and he said that the other guards were always talking about, oh yeah, I'm doing this karate thing and I can learn how to, you know, to rip a guy's heart out and show it to him while he's still breathing, and all of, you know, just talking about the good
old 70s and 80s and 60s of Bushido.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, you talked about killing and stuff. So he had this idea that the martial arts was all about killing, and he just would not sign off on it. Well, took about 15 years of me hassling him and wearing him down, and finally got to join a school after a buddy of mine. We saw a little movie that I don't think anybody's ever heard of called The Perfect Weapon, starring somebody named Jeff Speakman. And, you know, saw that and said, man, we gotta do this. And I was like, well, what is this? And I remember seeing a little sign that said Kenpo on it. And I was like, yeah, it's this Kenpo thing. We gotta get into that. So
yeah,
I started at a school in San Diego. And the school, we, you know, it was called the Chinese Kenpo. Chinese Kenpo Federation was the name of the school at the time. And the curriculum was essentially that of Tracy's Kenpo curriculum. So did that for a few years. Almost got to my third brown when I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, I got to do some Taekwondo and some Hapkido and some boxing. Nothing really super serious or really long term. Did that probably, I don't know, I guess about a year or so. And once I got out of the military, I ended up moving to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, decided that, you know, I still wanted to keep training, but I couldn't find a school that really suit my needs and I really enjoyed. So I just kind of did my own thing and, you know, just kind of kept up with what I could remember from my Kenpo training. Then I found my other core art, and that is of capoeira. And I've been doing, you know, capoeira for coming up on 17 years now.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, just been really, really, really enjoying that. And just met a lot of great people through that and just kind of doing, you know, doing that. But, you know, I still kept my love for Kenpo. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I found a school that suited my needs, and it is an American Kenpo, you know, lineage school, Ed Parker Lineage School. My instructor, he got his third and fourth degrees from Larry Tatum, so I'm in that lineage. But yeah, I've been enjoying that. I got to my green belt at the end of August, and so. Yeah, just working my way through, and now part of the instructor's program. So feels good to start on the teaching side again. I didn't sign up to be an instructor at my original school because since I knew I was leaving for the military, I didn't want to, you know, get all all set up there. But in the years that I was doing Capoeira, I did essentially inherit the school, the group that I was part of, and spend a lot of time, you know, teaching there. So I am familiar with it. Teaching Capoeira and teaching Kempo are a little bit different. So, you know, learning the nuances, but yeah, it's been fun. And, you know, now I have this podcast and getting to talk to great people. So, so I will turn it over. Go ahead and fill me and the listeners in on how Kempo found you and how your martial arts journey got started. And
sure,
we'll just kind of go from there.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Reggie. I appreciate it. And, it's always an honor to, have someone interested in my little background story and, also be a part of a show that's, awesome as far as the people you're getting on and the masters that you've had on in the past. It's an honor to be a part of that. So thank you. I actually started in Shaolin Kempo, which the way I look at Shaolin Kempo, it's kind of a derivative of American Kempo and Chinese Kempo, because it came after the Tracy's and after the Ed Parker syllabuses, my understanding. So I started back in Irvine, California. I was born in Mississippi. Then I went to Alabama. And when I was, I think, just starting kindergarten, we moved to Edmond, Oklahoma. And I spent, I think, up until third grade, till I was about 9 years old, 8 years old. I spent those few years in Edmond. I did some Taekwondo back then. But then when I moved to Irvine, California, I believe it was 1984. By 1985, if it wasn't 84, I think it was about 1985, though, is when I found the Shaolin Kempo School under Fred Villari. This was before the so-called dojo wars took place between Villari and Matera. I'm not sure if you've ever heard those stories.
I've heard
over the years and what I know. when money gets wrapped in martial arts, unfortunately, the politics start to become toxic. Yeah. And the money, I think, in my humble opinion, becomes more important than the art. And that's exactly what's happened multiple times between, unfortunately, those factions over the years, even recently. But it was a good karate school. It was in the 80s, so we had some – my instructor was old school. The syllabus, obviously, in my opinion, no offense to anyone listening who's still training in Shaolin Kempo, it's a very classically driven system. So it's very – the differentiation between the Kung Fu and the karate blend in Shaolin Kempo is, to me, far more apparent than it is in the Ed Parker system, where it kind of really naturally blends together and progressively blends together. Whereas in the Shaolin Kempo syllabus, I found that you started with traditional pinyins and katas, Japanese style. And you basically did those katas and pinyins all through your colored belts, your underbelts. And then once you got into the brown belt range and closer to black belt, you started to learn more of the Chinese Shaolin Kung Fu forms. Learning both of those styles so separately was, I found, beneficial 30 years later when I stumbled upon American Kempo, because it gave me such an amazing base, like classical base and understanding of literally Japanese style motion and Chinese style motion. So when years and years later, when I decided to leave that syllabus behind and I met Grandmaster Tatum, and he took me under his wing, it was much easier, I found, for me to develop an understanding of the American Kempo motion. So because of that base that I had for so many years, that classical base, as far as the practical side of the Shaolin Kempo syllabus I'm talking about, it's still kind of, I think, caught back in time. You know, it's a little stuck. And it's, you know, you're still doing half mooning. You're doing a lot of classical knife hand blocks. You're not considering active players in the game, meaning, you know, somebody not just half mooning forward and punching and you working around that arm, which I still find you got to be careful in the approach, which I'm sure we'll get into in American Kenpo, because you have to, in my humble opinion, in order to progress and evolve the system, it has to be done against somebody actively shooting a right and a left and a right and, you know, headhunting. So I call it active shooter because that's what it is. It's somebody who's going to shoot you is not going to just put one bullet in you. They're going to unload. So, anyway, back to my beginnings, I, like you, I was very much influenced by, Shokasugi, you know, you know, the ninja movies,
Enter the Ninja, Enter the Ninja, first one.
Yeah, it was.
I really liked. There was this one, Rage of Honor, I believe. It was either Rage of Honor or Rage and Honor.
Revenge of the Ninja. It was Revenge of the Ninja and Return of the Ninja that were the two big ones for me. And of course, back then we had all the great action films with Steven Seagal and Van Damme and stuff. So I was a Kung Fu magazine kid. I mean, I was always going to the back of the magazine just begging my parents to get me those ninja stars and those ninja claws. I would make my own stuff all the time, man. I was constantly pulling nails out of the garage and some duct tape and taping those nails up into a ninja star. Totally dangerous stuff for an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid to do. But, you know, parenting wasn't so soft back then. So my parents let me
do things. I know. I still traumatize many people that I talk to in that, when I was in elementary school, growing up in San Diego, we actually took a field trip. This was a school-sanctioned field trip. We took a school-sanctioned field trip to Tijuana. And people do not believe that this was something that
happened. I believe it. How old are you, Reggie?
I am 46.
Okay, so you're in my school. I'm 49. So yeah, man. You know, it was a whole another level of living back then.
Until the street lights went dark,
you were out playing in the summertime, man, and nobody cared. I'd get up at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, and me and my buddies would meet out front on our bikes, and we just told mom and dad, we're going to be gone today. They'll say, call at noon, find a payphone, and we would go off exploring, whether it be up in the orange groves or in the woods, and back when Orange County was actually Orange County. Where there was actually orange trees, and strawberry fields and avocado groves and such, or we just take a drive as far west as we could through Woodbridge University. I mean, miles and miles of exploration. Nobody cared. I mean, as long as you were home before dark or by dark, and then after that, you were out in the street still playing, running along people's walls like ninjas, jumping on their roofs.
That
was the way it was. Anyway, so I was heavily influenced, like you, like I said, by the movies and by the Kung Fu show and Bruce Lee and so on and so forth. So when I got into I begged my parents, and they were very much about it, you know. A lot of it, when I moved from Oklahoma, it was pre-puberty. My voice was quite high, and I had a pretty thick Southern accent, which a lot of the Southern California kids did not recognize much. And, the bullying was true. And so, I wanted to learn how to fight. And that's one of the main reasons why I got involved was I wanted to learn how to fight. And that, you know, seeming that into what I was talking about with the Shaolin Kenpo syllabus, the one thing about that company, the pro was that it developed really good fighters. We sparred a lot. And all the way up through the 2000s, I mean, I was part of that group of Shaolin Kenpo. You know, the company changed names, but I was still part of that same syllabus. And I became a teacher and very close to actually starting one of their schools for them because it was a franchise. But glad I didn't. Glad I pulled out. But anyway, it was one benefit was that we were very much pushed to fight a lot. And that was awesome. And there's some still to this day, some excellent fighters and also just martial artists in that syllabus, you know, in that company and in that style. there's something to be said about the classics. In fact, a lot of the students, when I started my company, Shaolin American, back in 2011, I was managing a school in Studio City under United Studios of Self-Defense, which they had another fallout and split, which became Z Ultimate. When we were told that morning, we showed up to the dojo that we had to take our United Studios patches off and replace them with these Zorro patches. That's when they lost me. And they lost a lot of people. It was just kind of like, what? And again, teach his own. There's still guys out there that I respect and love, you know, in that system, and stuck with it. But it was just not for me. The fighting that they did, though, in the academy that I was a part of, in the martial arts academy, was there. Once my students who followed me, because when I left that company in 2010, 2011, and I began my journey here under my own flag, about 75% or so of that school left with me. So when I opened my doors here, I had over 50, 60 students the first night that we had class. Kids and adults, families and adults. So, but it was difficult for some of them, especially some of the higher ranks, the green and brown belts who came with me, because they enjoyed that classical kata, that classical pinyin. They enjoyed the art that kind of made up that syllabus. And it was a lot easier, too, to learn. I mean, you had four techniques per belt on average, versus the 24 techniques we have in the syllabus. I teach them 16.
I always kind of laugh at that. You know, another thing that I stunned some of my peers with is, so at my original school, we had 40 techniques per belt. And at my current school, we're on the 16 technique syllabus. So it's like, oh, you know, I got to learn 16. Like, I had to learn 40 each belt.
Yeah.
And had to do well, we them only all had, like, each test.
In the Shaolin Kempo world, you had, you know, I think at some ranks, if I remember right, you had like 4 to 6. You got really good at those. really good at those before you tested. But anyway, back to the 80s. I stuck with it throughout my whole childhood. I was a career actor from age 9 on, which is a whole nother part of my life. And I started acting around the same year as I started training in Kempo. I even got a couple of movies due to my martial arts training. So they kind of worked hand in hand. And of course, because I had a good, you know, I grew up with some good instructors, the character development was there, and the martial arts was a really good part of my life. Positive, made a lot of positive impact on my growth and my studies and being a professional actor and all that. It just helped me be responsible and such, which is a huge part of it as a kid. You know, less, I always tell the parents that come in, it's less to me about the punches and the kicks at certain ages than it is about the character development and producing really good human beings out there in the world and leaders and so on and so forth. So I went through, I think by the time I was around 16 or so, I was a green belt, brown belt. I know I got caught at around second brown in that syllabus, in that system. And then I really started working a lot, you know, and then of course, high school took over, college took over, and I was on tour with a show on Nickelodeon for a long time. So my training was not as consistent. I'd be in the dojo 3-4 times a week for a few months at a time, and then I'd book a job that took me away for 3 or 4 months, you know. Now when I traveled, you know, like when I was doing a movie up in Utah for like a month, I found a dojo up there and I trained weekly while I was on set, you know, filming. But I got stuck at that second brown for, I think I want to say 15 plus years, brown belt. Then I ended up booking a show in New York City. I lived there from 1997 till around 2002. I lived in New York City. And there was no Kempo there at that time that I knew of. I kept on trying to find it, and I just couldn't find a school. I think there was Tiger Shulman was kind of basic karate, and then there was some MMA. I ended up meeting somebody out and about that was into Kung Fu, and he invited me to join a class down in Chinatown with his Sifu, who did not speak a lick of English, down in this basement. I'll never forget. And I would go down there once a week for a while and just do traditional Kung Fu, which was awesome. It was a great experience. So that was pretty much those 4 or 5 years I was living in New York, what I was getting in training, except for when I visited LA, I'd always go back to my dojo down in Hollywood just for some classes. But I moved back in, I think, 2002, and I immediately found a school. I was, I think, around 28 years old or so at that point, and I needed desperately to go ahead and focus and get my black belt. That's something I promised my father back in 1985. I said, I'm going to get my black belt if you sign me up. And so I remember getting back involved with the classes and training and not wearing my brown belt. I took my belt off. I just had my gi on, and I'd stand in the back of the room for the first several months until I kind of filled up my cup again with the syllabus. And then I put my brown belt back on, and then I trained some more to finally get certified to that final stripe on the brown belt. Because the Chinese, the Shaolin Kempo is the same belt system.
Oh, same Kempo. Rank structure.
Right, okay. Yeah. The only difference is they put a stripe on the blue and they put a stripe on the green, which I actually kept for business purposes in my American Kempo school, just because I think splitting it up with a stripe, being that between blue and green is at least about a year, if not more, it's healthy for the mind to be able to go, okay, I'm getting there. So I, within 6 to 8 months of getting that blue belt, you test for that green stripe, and then you fill in the rest of the blanks between the stripe and the green belt, which I find helps, for the dojo business.
We do that at the school that I'm at. You get a stripe when you hit the halfway point in between a belt. You test for a stripe, and then.
Yeah, and then it helps. I mean, especially when you're running a big school. You know, if it was a garage school, I probably wouldn't do it. But, humans like, why do you think the belts became, I think my understanding was it was white, orange, maybe a green, a brown, and a black or something like that back in the day. And then Ed Parker, I supposedly decided to add the colors, to elongate the process and to not lose so many students in frustration of how long it takes to get rewarded. So it's really just a human thing, I think. It's human nature to want to feel like you're getting somewhere. And then you go way back when it was just a white belt that eventually turned black, right? Due to the that's kind of my story. I found my school again back when I was moved back to California, trained. I got my first degree black belt in Shaolin Kempo in May of, is that my second? Yeah, that's my first. Yeah, May of 2007. Like I said, I had been a brown belt for, I want to say 15, 16, 17 years. And I started teaching. Actually, Jared Podos, who teaches for me here, he's the dojo manager here. He was one of my first students, and I was still wearing a first degree brown belt at the time when I started teaching him as a white belt. And we got moving there. I made it all the way up to third degree black belt in Shaolin Kempo before I decided to go off and do my own thing, which the thought process hit me around 2010. Just because what was going on with that franchise, so much political drama within and turmoil between Master Matera, Charles Matera, and his board of directors and some of the other masters were having a lot of disagreements. Very similar to what happened between Mr. Matera and Mr. Villari back in the 80s. It was all about money for the most part. Let's just call a spade a spade. It's the truth. I mean, it was a big business and a big money-making business at that. I mean, I know at one point when Volari Studios pushed their way through to the West Coast from the East Coast. It was probably one of the most successful franchise martial arts businesses in the country. And then when they had the big dojo wars, people were breaking into each other's dojos and smashing windows and cutting up their carpet in their dojos and smashing the mirrors. It was ridiculous, but there was all that going on in the mid '80s to late '80s. And then, they finally hashed that out and Charles Matera's group became United Studios of Self-Defense. And my school ended up, I believe, going to that. We took our Fred Volari patches off and put the United Studios patches on. Then that whole thing happened between Matera and some of his students, really. They were the board of directors for United Studios. They split, and one half became Z Ultimate, and the other half became United Studios, or stayed United Studios. And I just had enough. I saw over the years that I was an assistant instructor and co-managing the school in Studio City. I just saw a lot of stuff that I was like, this is not to me what it's about. You know, the way they were training us in our academy of teachers, martial arts instructors, it was very much marketing, marketing, marketing. It was almost kind of like a pyramid scheme. If you do this, you're going to get this. Bonus, you know, and that kind of stuff. I was like, well, what happened to the ethics of just teaching solid martial arts guys? They didn't like us working with people's budgets, and I was big on working with families in need and such. And I was always breaking the rules, making deals. You know, if you can't afford us, you still need this. Let's get you in. I might not be able to give you the full program, but what can you afford? You know, and I was that guy.
So it's a fine line to. You know, the martial arts, the business side and the art side, it's a very fine line to deal with, where it's like, you want us on one side, you want to spread the art to everybody that's interested, but then on the other side it's like, oh, I got rent to pay and things.
Yeah.
And it's very tricky to
navigate
those.
It sure can, especially when you want to do it the right way and ethically. Back in 2010, when I started getting a little frustrated and I was making pennies for the hours. I mean, I was putting 40 plus hours on the mats a week and I was barely being able to pay rent. And I kept on asking for more money because I was the one growing the school at that time. And hence why majority of the school left with me. Was because I was the guy that signed him up, you know, and nothing against anybody that was involved in that, including the chief instructor of the school at the time. I still have a ton of respect for him, and I felt horrible when I made the decision to leave. It was not a personal decision against him. It was basically against the company and the structure of that corporate world that I wanted out of. And what also helped was me stumbling upon American Kenpo, which we were told year after year, you know, anytime you brought up Ed Parker or American Kenpo in the Shaolin Kenpo world, specifically this company, they would shoot it down like, oh, you know, Kenpo's Kenpo, you know, stay away from those guys. They're going to hurt you. I remember hearing that a lot. Stay away from those American Kenpo guys. If you go into one of those dojos, you're going to get hurt. And I started thinking, because I was far more into, I mean, I was working as a bouncer. I was trying some new things other than acting, because I had been acting for so long. I just got burnt out in my mid-30s. I was kind of starting to just feel the pressure of anxiety of trying to chase that next contract and so on and so forth. And I've been doing it since I was a kid. So it was time for me personally to make a decision in looking into other means of income and career choices. I wanted a backup plan. I loved the industry. I loved being an artist. I loved being an actor. It was a lot of fun. It was, my whole life was pretty much wrapped around that industry. And I had some amazing times, amazing experiences, but I hit a point where in my life I wanted something else. And so I was bouncing at local clubs. I was running the door. I ran a team up the street here at a lounge club, security, really enjoying that, but it started opening my eyes to the need of really fine tuning the practical side of my training. And when I ran into the American Kenpo world, that and I started watching those videos of the techniques, and I started seeing the value of that syllabus versus the old classical syllabus that I was, you know, I grew up in. I started sharing some of the American Kenpo techniques at the Shaolin Kenpo school with my students. And I'd use, like, say, five swords, or I'd use shielding hammer or delayed sword. Mm-hmm. I started using these techniques as little mini themes through my adult group classes specifically. And the adults are like, where are you getting this from? It's so much so much more practical, and it makes more sense than half moon back with the right leg, knife hand block, front kick, mm-hmm. tiger back fist. You know, it's a basic, you know, that's not a bad technique if you know how to pull it off, but it wasn't American Kenpoized yet, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's when I started seeing the value, because my students were like, wow, what is this stuff? You know, this stuff's awesome. And I remember calling Mr. Tatum, because I was looking, once I decided to go ahead and leave and start my own school, I was very undecided in regards to what I was going to teach. Was I going to stick to the Shaolin Kenpo syllabus, or was I going to blend some other things in with it and create my own syllabus? I was pretty much lost, but I had already jumped ship and I was well on my way. I had the funding. One of my students graciously, you know, offered to fund my business. Which helped immensely. I had a ton of support from the school that I was leaving. So all the way to the point where I remember, I still have it. I had a list of all the students who had confirmed they were going to come with me. And then I did the math and I knew that I could afford the rent right off the bat. So I was already in the positive there.
Oh, very good.
So that was a really unique scenario for opening your own business. And so I remember when I called Larry, I said, I introduced myself and I said, may I come and meet you? I'm looking for a new teacher. And I told him a little bit about my story and he said, yeah, of course, you know, please come on by. I'm right here in Pasadena. And I was like, perfect. So I met with him and I got along with him. We got on the mats. He asked me to show him Akata, show him some of the stuff that I knew. And he's like, well, you move really well. He says, you know, let's teach you the syllabus. And I started training. He started with delayed sword. He started with short form one, you know. He started teaching me the differences between a right half moon stance and a right neutral bow. And, oh, wow, cool. My groin's no longer showing. I'm no longer aligned. That front foot's no longer at 12 o'clock, you know. Now I'm off angle. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. No more half mooning. Step through forward, step through reverse. Oh, wow, that makes a lot of sense, too. I'm not going to necessarily half moon. I'll C-step maybe in a fight, but I'm not going to half moon forward and punch you. So all of that kind of started to come together. And I remember asking Mr. Tatum, sir, can you look at some of the Shaolin Kenpo syllabus with me and help me evolve it and make it work? And because I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some of the American Kenpo techniques and choose which ones I want to teach, and then I'll blend that in. I think I'm going to keep the katas and the pinions because I really like the Japanese and Chinese traditional forms. And I remember him looking at me kind of, you know, curiously. He just said, Donnie, I don't think you're going to have near as much success as you think by blending, because you're going to confuse your students. And he goes, I know, I've done that. I've done this before. I've transitioned studios from one syllabus of Kenpo to the American Kenpo syllabus, and it's scary and it takes some time. You may lose a few students, but you're also in the long term going to gain more. And it was really hard for me to swallow that, because I knew that some of my higher ranks were going to fight this. They were going to be upset that they made it all the way to green belt or even brown belt. And they followed me thinking that we were going to do Shaolin Kenpo. But yet I'm going to throw them right back to white belt in American Kenpo. Mm-hmm. You know? So it was very,
it's tough to start over. When I started at the school that I'm at now, you know, I at the time didn't really know that there was you know, different versions of Kenpo. And it was like, okay, well, you know, you were at a Chinese Kenpo school, and now this is American Kenpo school. So, you know, you're starting back over at white belt. And at the time, I was like a little bummed. I'm not gonna lie, I was a little bummed because you know I worked pretty hard to get my green belt before.
And, sure.
But you know, in the end, I was glad that happened because I mean, I learned so much more by the time I was an orange belt than I did being a green belt, just with the terminology, the principles, not just doing the how. You know, no disrespect to my original instructor, he's amazing. I love him dearly, but that just the curriculum was different and had a different focus.
It had answers, man. It had answers. That's what changed my whole perspective of the arts, you know, of Kenpo in general, whether you're spelling it with an N or an M. Another thing I learned was that the proper way to spell it is an N. You know, there's a couple of different stories, I guess, behind that and how that changed, but we don't have to get into it. But yeah, I listened to Mr. Tatum. It took me a bit. I remember my first reaction was, okay, yeah, I'm going to do it my way. But the one thing that he said to me that really stuck, not only was the fact that I was going to confuse my students, but he said, Donnie, in the long run, you need an umbrella. You need a larger family, universal, you know, internationally. And by doing what you're thinking about doing, which a lot of martial artists, he felt, make the mistake of doing, creating your own syllabus. He says, first of all, who are you to create your own syllabus as a third degree black belt? And that really hit me, you know, but it was absolutely, in my opinion, correct. You know, I wasn't a master yet. I hadn't, you know, I might be a talented martial artist, but I wasn't a master. I didn't have what it really takes. And then he's like, you're also going to put yourself on a lone island. You're going to be a rogue. And when your students maybe need to move or, you know, they leave you to go somewhere else, they're not going to have a language to speak universally. And the American Kenpo syllabus gives you a international community that speaks the same, if not a very similar language, even though we might have a different takes, perspectives, approaches. There's still that heart of Kenpo. I mean, you can even mix it up with the Tracy Kenpo guys because of the syllabus is so similar. Whereas the Shaolin Kenpo was a lot of, again, no disrespect out there because I like you, I have a lot of respect for my past and my upbringings and the classical base that it gave me, but it was plagiarism. The katas, nothing was original. It was all taken from Ed Parker and Tracy and then the Chinese Kung Fu, the monks. It was really just a bunch of cherry picking and we're just gonna place it here and we're gonna place it there. And out of respect for that idea, it's extremely digestible for the average Joe, the average, you know, soccer mom or somebody who's really just not in it for bruising because you made very little contact unless you were sparring. And even then, depending on which dojo you were in, you didn't make a lot of contact. You may, you know, but whatever the case, it's a beautiful model for making a lot of money as a martial arts instructor. But again, my big tug was ethics. If I'm going to be a self-defense, quote unquote, school, I have to be in a syllabus that's going to evolve and progress through the years and last and stay fresh. And I need a perspective that's going to work and not be a charlatan act in front of these people. And you look in my school today, my adult program, I have bruisers in there who fought, who've had black belts in other arts, who weekly go to the local Muay Thai place to get in the ring. I mean, they're no joke and they'll see right through you. And especially when I got into the security world and bouncing and stuff at the clubs, people see right through you on what you're studying. And are you really into self-defense or are you doing, you know, just Shotokan karate? And there's a lot of again, benefits to those classical arts. They give you such a great base. They teach you, if taught and approached correctly, power and speed and so on and so forth. But then when it comes down to the conceptual parts, the techniques, the street self-defense ideas and principles of motion, that stuff is what, in my humble opinion, really, really is important if you're going to call yourself a self-defense school, specifically in today's world. You know, if American Kenpo is going to continue being successful, it has to evolve, just like Mr. Parker says in his books and in his teachings you find online and stuff, those seminars that he says it blatantly. This is not stagnant. This is never supposed to be stagnant. It's supposed to be an ever-evolving art. And I can guarantee you, and I'm sure this rustles people's feathers when it's said, but 25 plus years now, if he was still here, the American art would not, American Kenpo would not look the same. Hopefully, because that was not part of his plan. You know?
Yeah, and, I agree.
You know, and there, I do have a lot of respect, and I love the fact that there are still encyclopedias out there, masters who just say, this is the way I was taught it, and this is the way I'm going to do it. I love that because we need those people kind of keeping the history. I feel it's there's an importance there. It's not my approach, but I love that I can go back and see how Mr. Parker did it, or see how he taught it to that one person. Because my understanding is he was very, it's common of him to teach, you know, five swords five different ways, depending on where he was in the world.
Exactly.
But whatever the case, it needs to constantly evolve. And so that's what, you know, when Mr. Tatum said that to me, bouncing back to my little story in regards to how I got to where I am today, I went, okay. And then eventually, as he continued teaching me the yellow belt syllabus, orange sheet, the purple sheet, the blue sheet, and I started seeing the value, and I brought it back to my school every week, and I dumped it out onto my students as fast and furiously as I could. I started to realize, and it took about a year or two, how valuable that syllabus was. So eventually I was able to basically put aside the Shaolin syllabus. I tested a few more people up through the first year or two, and then I just stopped. In fact, at Sensei Jared Potos, my number one here, for first black belt, basically, his black belt certification, his certificate, is the only one I had ever put Shaolin American Kenpo on it. Because that day of 8 hours of testing, it was brutal. He did the entire Shaolin Kenpo syllabus up to first degree, and he did the entire American Kenpo syllabus up to first degree.
Wow.
And he was the only student that I consider certified up to through both syllabuses. His face was green. His eyes were in the back of his head. He's, you know, his lips were blue. He was done. We killed him that day, but he was able to manage both syllabuses out. So he's a very valuable person in my life. He also manages my school, which is awesome.
Yeah. No,
so that's it. And that's, you know, and then from there forward around 2000, you know, I opened my doors and I think it was June of 2011. By 2013, we were rolling, and we were just doing the 24 technique system. And I lost some students, specifically in the green and brown belt range. You know, they stuck with me for about a year, and they get frustrated because, oh, I should have been a black belt by now. And I'm like, is it about that? Come on, just stick with it.
Exactly, yeah.
And some of them didn't. They went back to the Shaolin world, or they quit altogether. They didn't like the bruising. They didn't like, you know, we started making a lot more heavy contact. Some of them, I didn't sign up for this. Well, I don't know. What did you sign up for? Because there's a dance studio right down there.
Exactly.
You can go tap dance, man. I mean, go, you know, or do some, what do they call it, wushu or whatever. There's plenty of classical martial arts that you don't make contact, but this is not one of them, you know. So anyway, and that's it, man. It's just been kind of jamming since. You know, I've gone through plenty of trials and tribulations, and learned the hard way many times over the 13 years or so that I've been in business in the American Kenpo world. But I got very lucky in finding a good teacher, and then after I trained with Mr. Tatum, and he, instead of giving me new rank, he certified me and he recognized me at third degree in American Kenpo once he felt I was up to par. And that took a few years, but he certified me up to, or recognized me as a third degree in American Kenpo, and that's kind of where I began, since I had already gotten the first three stripes.
Very nice. Yeah, I like that. I like that, you know, you sought out, you weren't getting, fulfilled with what you were doing. And I can relate to the, kind of that desire of, I want to kind of combine, I don't want to just jettison what I've been doing, but, here's this new thing that's getting my attention. And, with me going between the versions of Kenpo, it was like, yeah, I wanted to, and I still sort of have kind of this idea, but when I started training again, I was like, I want to go back and quote unquote finish my training in Chinese Kenpo and go back and get my black belt. But, as I started getting more and more things on my plate now, it's like, that's going to be a little tough. And
it's pretty hard.
Yeah.
American Kenpo syllabus to mix it up. I mean, I have a couple of students over the years who are overachievers and they think they're going to go get a blue belt in BJJ and a black belt in this, that, and the other, and still stick to American Kenpo. And I'm like, I try my best to encourage them, stick to one thing, master it. And then by brown belt, black belt, you can go and you can explore. But, we need to, I think, understand this is the American Kenpo syllabus. Ed Parker specifically is the art of overskill overkill. And it takes a lot to master this, a lot to get to the black belt, man.
Yeah, no,
a lot of brain width. That brain is filled by the time you're, like you said, at orange belt. That's the other thing that really was eye opening for me as an instructor, as a teacher, was watching the skills of my students, especially the ones who would sign up when I was just teaching American Kenpo. Their skill set from white belt to orange belt was the skill set from white belt to green belt in Shaolin Kenpo.
Mm-hmm.
It just promotes this, the principles of motion, like you said, the science behind this art, and especially if you're approaching it, in my humble opinion, the correct way of really uniquely tailor fitting it to the individual and teaching them through the principles of motion, not the choreography, but the principles of motion, I think, is important. And the skills that I saw these students that walked in as greenhorns, as white belts, within a couple of years of training was just night and day compared to, the more basic syllabus, yes. So, and it's extremely valuable. I mean, I love it because I'm constantly growing. I'm constantly getting ideas from others. I was lucky enough after training with Mr. Tatum to find, friends such as Master Angelo Coyado, and Scott Higgins and Paul Dye. And I got a wonderful couple of years with Master Mike Pick, Grandmaster Mike Pick. Any of the seminars that I've taken with Grandmaster Jeff Speakman and Mr. White, Bob White. And I've just been so lucky to have been exposed to so many different styles. It's because they each have their own slight flavor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Pick's Kenpo was small circles, just tons of power. I was just so, I was so amazed by that kind of small circle motion. And, Mr. Tatum's got that dragon whip and mm-hmm. speed and the long arms and the snap. And I was able to blend those two styles, the tiger and the dragon, kind of together. And as a teacher of many different body types, being exposed to all these different body types, in my training, personal training and my personal exploration has really helped me be able to see who's in front of me. What kind of body am I working with? What kind of brain am I working with? And how to develop their Kenpo, not Donnie Jeffco Kenpo, which I think is very important, very, very important. You cannot be a cookie cutter of your sensei. A lot of people out there try to, again, no offense to anybody listening, but I don't want my students to mimic me. I don't want them to look like me. They're going to have pieces of me within them, but then you got Juan Serrano here. He's Mr. Serrano. A very good friend of mine. We've just bonded immensely. He's part of my team here. and he's a little dude with mm-hmm. a lot of power, you know, and yeah. that right there, him being a part of my team has helped me grow immensely as an instructor, because I watch him move, and some of his tricks that he's had to develop his body type against somebody bigger has helped me as an instructor develop a way to teach smaller people, you know, and you know, he's a technician of the art. I mean, a true engineer, and he's made it work for his body type. And to me, that's what it's all about. You know, I give you that's why I love teaching abroad and teaching at other people's schools as a guest in seminars and stuff. Any chance I get, if I can get out there and do it, if I can afford the trip or make the time, I do, because that's where I test myself and that's where I grow. Mm-hmm. I put myself in front of other people who don't know me, who's never taken a class from me. And then I teach to them, and I fail sometimes. Oh, that didn't really work, did it? Yeah. Okay, let's try this. You know, then boom, I'm expanding my brain and my motion and my understandings of the art. And then, of course, then I get a chance to take the classes of the other senseis, of the other mm-hmm. masters, you know, and then I get back to my dojo, and I have a nice little notebook filled with ideas and fresh perspective, and I make it my own. Isn't that what Mr. Parker, in my humble opinion? I didn't know him. I wasn't lucky enough to ever be around him. But I've heard plenty of stories and read his books and watch his videos to this day. And I just love the approach of, this was an art that's supposed to be an addendum to other arts. It's supposed to, mm-hmm. you know, and I call it Kempo-wise. You Kempo-wise something, you know, I could take Shaolin Kempo now. I could take some of those Chinese Kempo techniques, and I could put a little American Kempo principles of motion behind it, and I can make them work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which is freaking awesome, you know?
Oh yeah. No, that's, you know, one of the many things that I love about Kempo is, yeah, you can connect it with the other arts. And, you know, I try not to do this every episode, but I guess I'm going to do it anyway. So, I always, seem to tell this story about, you know, back in the day, I was watching the, you know, dating myself, the Panther production videos.
And, oh yeah, I still have them.
Oh yeah, yeah. Those had to get my hands on all of those. But there was one in particular, David German, and he had the Kempo Jiu-Jitsu connection.
Yeah,
and he was mixing in Jiu-Jitsu with Kempo, and I was just like, oh, man, like, you know, I love. I always saw Kempo as a good base for connecting with other arts. So in my original school, you know, we were more of a kicking school because my instructor, you know, trained out of a Taekwondo school for quite a while. So we were much more kickers than Kempo folks are typically known to be. And you know, Wally J was his mentor, and, you know, he had all these kind of other things, attached into his Kempo. And so, you know, I always saw Kempo as a good base, and connecting it with other arts was really, really fun. But yeah. With this David German video, one that really stood out was he was adding these wrist locks and arm locks to Flashing Wings. And I was like, it fits so perfectly. It's just like, yeah, you can just do this here. And then, yeah, now you've got the wrist, or you got this arm bar. And I always thought Kempo was great for that. And
absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Another wonderful master, now grandmaster, Mr. Muhammad Tabatabai. He's influenced me a lot as well, especially with some of his Brazilian jiu-jitsu kind of blended in, and then again his takes on different techniques. One standing out, Prance of the Tiger. You know, no cat stands, just make it a street fight, you know.
Exactly.
One of my most favorite recent stumbles upon an amazing grandmaster of the art is Eddie Downey. Mr. Downey, oh, yes. In Ireland, I was just absolutely blessed with the opportunity to go and teach at some of my French friends in France. I had met through Mr. Collado, and I'll tell you about a little trip that we took in a few minutes. But through that trip, I met a bunch of people all over the world. And I was invited back for their anniversary of their dojo to teach alongside the Burgess brothers and Mr. Downey, who was their original teacher. Talk about intimidating. I was like, I'm just, who am I? These guys are their original teachers and they're 8th degrees, 10th degrees, you know, and I was a little 5th degree going over there, but it was just such an honor to share the mats and for them to be open for me giving my approach and teaching some of my ideas and such and sharing, was awesome. And that exposure to that Irish Kempo, you talk about tightening things up in a crowded bar approach, you know. You got, you know, I had a with Mr. Burgess, I was on the side talking about, what is it, Glancing Wing. And he's like, yeah, you know, I look at this as you're surrounded. You're up against the bar and you don't have any room to move. And the guy throws that uppercut at you. And he grabbed a hold of me and he just ragdolled me around with that technique, man. He would not let go. And it was just, oh, that's small Kempo, that small circle Kempo.
Yeah, very nice.
But, you know, I got a chance to get some of Mr. Downey's perspectives, and it was just awesome. I mean, everybody I've been exposed to, you know, regardless if their style is exactly what I'm looking for, I get there's gold. There's little mm-hmm. pieces of gold nuggets out there that you can find if you open your mind. And it's just like I always tell students that I teach, even my own students, take what you like and put aside what you don't. And that's how you're going to develop your own Kempo. I think if I remember right, in one of Mr. Parker's books, he says something about by blue belt level, you should be developing into your own Kempoist. Mm-hmm. By green belt, you should really have that sense of self in regards to just, okay, this is what my body likes. This is how I move. This is what works for me. And then, exactly. You know, you then go through your whole thesis process through brown belt to your first degree black belt, which is basically master of the basics, right? But mm-hmm. you've developed your own Kempo. And that's what I love about our school is it's not just me out there teaching. Yeah, I have somewhat of the final say of everything, but you have, you know, Jared Potos, Gabe Paolo, Juan Serrano, Carrie Larson, a countless group of wonderful black belts who we allow to assist us and teach. And all of these, I encourage these people, all these advanced students of mine, I encourage them to put their own spin on it. And if they question something, you can come to me and I'll be blatantly honest with you if I think it's crap. I usually try to make it positive. So it's like, oh, you know what? Don't do it that way. Let's try it this way or what have you. Because they'll find their way and they'll find something that, again, is that gold, that golden nugget, just through exploration, just through the laboratory. And that's what the match should be. It's just one giant laboratory. And I'm not saying we have to change a technique or rewrite the technique. But if something's old, it's old. If something's outdated, it's outdated. Hmm. You know, you buy a 9mm from 1950, 1965 or whatever. It's that is not the same. It's not the same. The same weapon as it would be if you bought it to 2024. You know, things have evolved. Weapons have evolved. So our own human body, as the weapon, should evolve. You know, and Kempo has to continue evolving. I keep saying this, and I know that there's plenty of people out there that say, "Oh, there's plenty Mr. Parker left us with. It doesn't need to change." But that's not what he said. You know, that's not what he said. The principles of motion are still there. The science that he created, the science behind it that he explored is still there. The patterns are still there. But who's to say we shouldn't explore different approaches and like the inserts and so on and so forth? It's that whole, you know, you can multiply it. Subtract, you know, you can add, you can subtract, you can multiply, you know, I believe in that. I'm not trying to change anything. I'm just trying to be real. The reality is somebody very likely in today's world of street fighting will shoot your legs. They're going to shoot for your legs. They're going to try to take you down to the ground. We have to consider that when we're exploring these concepts. And I hate to call the techniques anymore. I don't, I call them by their name when I can remember the name. But the reality is it's a concept. And if we look at it as conceptually based versus choreography based, then we're getting somewhere, in my humble opinion. You know, if I don't like my students to get caught up in memorization, I like them to get caught up in teaching their bodies patterns. And I love to bring out the fact that five swords is flashing wings, is obscure claws, and countless other techniques. You know, your body already learned, you just didn't know it, you know, and that's the trick. That's the beauty of American Kenpo is starting to seam together those relationships and those family groupings of just simple patterns, you know, and concepts, you know, so.
Exactly. All right. So, we'll move to our, lightning round here as, head towards wrapping up for today. So got a few little fun questions here. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
I love glancing wing. I love five swords. Everybody loves five swords.
five swords.
I love intellectual departure.
Yeah, that isn't, you know, I always kind of scratch my head about that one because pretty much every Kenpo person I've talked to loves that technique. And it always, I get that it was maybe considered too advanced for an early technique, but I can't seem to understand why it was removed versus just moved.
I still teach it. Yeah. I think we should take Grasp of Death and move that somewhere else and replace it with Intellectual Departure. I know then we don't get a headlock in the yellow sheet, but Grasp of Death is tough to teach a brand new white belt. Mm-hmm. I know, again, I break it down into concepts, but let's just do Grip of Death. Yeah. It makes so much more freaking sense, you know? You'll lose lessons if you don't teach it, so I still teach the concept, but... you know, Intellectual Departure, I think, is so important to teach because of that, the need of just that sporadic, that organic defense, that flinch defense, I call it, you know, just like taking your extended outward blocks and starting to flinch them versus doing the classical. That gives you good structure, but in a street fight, you better learn to flinch block to organically get those elbows up and protect your neck, protect your jaw, protect your face, you know, and boy, does shielding hammer work. If you, instead of going bang, 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 it's right there. Tomahawk, bang. There's a lot of cool things that you got to start again. You got to start with your ABCs, teach it classically, and then you go into your what if and your formulaic, right? But other than those, man, there's so many techniques. I'm so bad with the names. Thank God I have some guys with brains. What's the one, You inward boom pop. It's a brown pop. You might not know it yet.
It kind of looks familiar, but I don't.
I love flashing wings. I love thundering hammers.
The Kenpo All Stars, as I like to call them.
They're
techniques that are in that seem to be in every version of, you know, like for me, you know, five swords, thundering hammers, flashing wings were at my original school. And, you know, they're at my current school. And, yeah, every version of Kenpo, I seem to see those techniques. I call them my all-stars because they're in everyone, and they're usually people's favorites. So.
Yeah. I love Detour from Doom. I like to play with that. I love to mess around with the tackles, the rams, charging ram and broken ram and such. I like to work those against the BJJ, like hip shoots, not just the charge. You look back at the old videos, I always get a little bit of a laugh, but you know, you see the old technique lines where everybody's running at each other like they're Santa Claus a hug. I'm like, that's not how it's gonna be, man. Nobody's gonna widen up their arms and start 5 feet, but you know, they're gonna shoot, and when they shoot, it's your ass is gonna be on the ground if you don't know how to sprawl, you know. And, oh man, you gotta go there. I've got a guy in here, one of my black belts. He's phenomenal, and his name's Jamar, and he's just a badass. He's just a fighter. I wouldn't want to fight him in the street. And I always use him. Like I go, all right, let's break down charging ramp tonight. Take a big deep breath. I'm like, all right, Mr. Jamar, come on up. All right. Now, don't be nice to me. Take me down. And within 2 seconds, I'm down on the ground. And I love it. And all the students are laughing. And of course, you always get that yellow or orange belt who's really learning a technique, you know, in the night, a little advanced. Raise their hand and they're like, well, what about this technique that's going to work then? I mean, you just got slammed. I'm like, well, that's what we're here for. We're going to explore this. And now it's time to hit the laboratory. Let's make this work against something so extreme, you know?
Exactly. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Short form 3 is my favorite form of all times. I love long form 4. I love long 6. But I love the flow of short 3, and it's tidy and just fun. Fun to explore the seams, you know, seaming it together timing wise and such. I like a lot of the second sets. I like elbow set or striking set too. I love the variations that you can find online. I was just teaching that a couple nights ago in a private lesson, and we were talking about all the different variations and how if you look way back to one of the old Ed Parker videos of it, it was not just an elbow set, it was a striking set. So whereas somewhere over time, it's evolved into like the figure eight elbows, right? Those figure eight elbows were actually hammers. That was the figure eight of hooking wings. By the way, I love hooking wings. Yeah, they actually didn't do the elbows. It was hammers, right? It was more strikes within striking set two than elbow set. I call ours elbow set because I really tried my best to take a bunch of different versions that I'd learned. It's primarily the Tatum version, but with a few tweaks here and there to make sure that we covered all of the elbows that you can find in the art, including, you know, flaps and downward flaps, upward flaps, so on and so forth. So, but I do enjoy that. I love coordination set too. If done, you know, properly with the use of the forward bow and sticking that leg back, and you know, you get some Superman punches in coordination set away. So,
very good. All right, and then final question: if there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
Bruce Lee and Ed Parker, I would say right off the bat. Within what I teach, you know, in today's world, if I could train with Shokasugi or some of those guys, I'd love to actually share the mats with Steven Seagal, just because I think some of his Aikido is pretty awesome, you know, street fighting. Chow. I mean, wouldn't it be cool to go back and actually train with Chow or even Matosi, you know? Any of the old masters.
I like it. All right. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Now is your time to go ahead and you can plug anything or just anything that we hadn't talked about that you wanted to mention before we close out. And now's your time.
Oh, man, I enjoyed the chat. Thanks for listening to my rambling. I always enjoy it. Kind of gets a bunch of thoughts and stuff out. So honored to be included on your podcast, Reggie. I appreciate the invite. You're doing a good thing for the community. It's pretty awesome. So kudos to you and anybody who's in the arts. If you're ever in North Hollywood or the Los Angeles area and want to stop by, it's a welcome mat. We're always welcoming to good people. Leave your egos at home, come on in and enjoy our time. Let's just keep evolving, keep progressing, keep moving forward, and let's keep American Kempo fresh for our kids.
I like it. Well, yeah, thank you again. I can't wait to get this out to everyone to hear, and just thank you again for your time.
You too, brother. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkempo.com. Thank you.